Welcome to Taking Back Our Corners, the officially unofficial podcast for We Own the City on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about episode 4, just two episodes from the end here. Aaron, what'd you think of this one?
I thought it was interesting because they really narrowed the focus down. I think this is the first time that the bulk of my notes has been from a single thread. This Detective Ward, which I don't think we've seen much of or heard much of. He seemed like a new, you know, kind of, he was a new guy on the, I guess one of the guys recruited by Jenkins as opposed to the sergeant that we saw last week, the guy who got promoted to the DEA. So he was able to kind of bring us an outside, like 360 perspective on how this works from a guy who, I'm not going to say he's not dirty.
Right. Right.
But he definitely, we're getting a perspective from, I guess, a reasonable person, you know, a reasonable.
I get the impression that if Jenkins were this guy, they never would have busted these dudes because this guy is a little bit smarter, you know, and not as greedy.
Yeah, maybe just have a little bit more, you know, civic. I don't know. I like I said, it's like that's. It's a crazy system if you're entrusting individual beat cops on what is, you know, ethically and morally correct. I think it was good. It was a good perspective because it shows like what we're talking about last week about like why do the policemen, the average police, the presumably non-rotten barrel that we're supposed to be talking, why do they think about this when they're seeing it? Why do they do the things? And I like that they made it explicit there at the end where the guy's like, you know, like, well, if you know all this is wrong and you're not even in benefiting from it, well, then why the hell did you do this? And I thought the ward laid out a pretty, you know, look, well, because nobody else is doing anything about it. I don't want to be targeted. I don't want to be singled out. I don't want to be seen as a narc. I'm glad that the show kind of made that explicit because before it was kind of things that you could surmise. What did you think of this episode?
This really cast the people involved in a new light for me. We get the title being said in this episode, and that scene, to me, really like put some light on that line in the intro that says these guys are 1930s gangsters, right? Talking about the cops who are running these rackets, and I realize that's what it is, right? It's a racket. It's not that these guys are like not getting paid enough and need to go get more money to make this job worthwhile. It's that they see an opportunity to run a racket within law enforcement and they're taking it, right? They're running this like they're entrepreneurs running a tech startup. Like
they're disrupting the market.
Right, right. Like they see a niche, right? They see a place where they can get in and get theirs and they are taking it. And it really like when I watched that final scene of him just like sitting in the restaurant with his friends, talking about how like the city is ours, we own it. That's one of the more disgusted moments I've had during this series, in a series full of disgusting moments. Yeah, understood these guys.
And you think that like, I wonder, and you'll never know. I don't know how you could do an experiment like this that's ethical, but like I think a high percentage of people would do this type of behavior with these type of incentives. Like, I think that's the point of this show is that this is a logical course of action. If these are the inputs and outputs that you see before you, if this is the oversight, if these are the rationales you'll be giving that like you are the only thing, you're the thin blue line that stands between chaos and corrupt, then like, and you might take a bullet at any time. You might not come home with your family. The city might rise up in support of thugs and murderers. And you're on the wrong end of that equation as a law enforcement officer. It's like, it's a very exceptional person personified by people like Detective Souter that is going to hold up most people, even good ones. Like, and I use good, you know, in quotation marks, like this Detective Ward are going to find a way to try to drive their moral and ethical calculus between those two poles. Very few people are going. That's the whole, you know, it's like you always hear that it's like a few bad apples, but that phrase is spoils the bunch. And you see guys like, I have no doubt that Detective Ward would have been an excellent officer and would have done the city proud in a gun trace task force and made a lot of money doing it, by the way.
Yeah, 170K with overtime is nothing to sneeze at.
That's just a shit you can tell the IRS. Like, that's right. That's more right. money than I've ever fucking made slinging code. And I thought we were the grossly overpaid fat cats. So, yeah, like, I think that that's the thing. It's like you, and it makes me wonder, like, you know, I've thought, like, in the last 5 years, like, what the fuck is up with the systemic, you know, like, racism, and you talk about these racist cops, and you hear about, like, some of the, you know, the feds investigating, like, you know, different racist takeovers departments, but I wonder how much of it is just the corruption, and this corruption attracts a certain type and repels a certain type. And we've been doing that for like a generation or two. And like all our Metro cops are just kind of like rotten.
Yeah, that's the thing. Once the apples spoil the bunch is spoiled, right? And you can't put a bunch of good apples into that barrel and expect them to remain good.
It's just like one of those things where like it's just another list of the pile of problems we have in society. They're all like super hot button critical things to fix, but yet they're all enmeshed and they're all entwined. And like, you know, if we're going to have a resurgence of crime in this country, and there is some indications that you know, after historical lows we've enjoyed for almost my entire life, that we're starting to see an uptick in that stuff. Like, how the hell are you going to fight that when you've got, you know, you've got a bucket of dirty mop water to do it with?
Yeah.
So it's a great episode. It's a terrible episode.
Right. That's the story of the show.
Yeah. Shall we begin?
Yeah, let's do it.
But first, let's take a quick break.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
All right, I'm doing the best I can because I'm trying to. I had to make some judgment calls on what is and isn't part of the federal investigation. What is the part the parts that pertain to Detective Maurice Ward. And I guess like most of the Wayne stuff I'm going to put into here, with the exception of a few things that I don't think the investigators know. Like, so anything that the investigators know that's part of Wayne's story or is told from outside his POV, we're going to shove in here. And we're going to start at an odd place, which is we haven't seen Kilpatrick and McDougal since like the first two episodes. They come back. The feds are starting to move forward with this investigation of Gondo and these other corrupt cops involved with Shropshire, and they're just finding out that Wayne Jenkins is the new sergeant. His sergeant got bumped up to the DEA. He's taking over, And the lady investigator, FBI agent, says, you know, I know this guy. I've met him. Seems like a good guy. We should give him a heads up. He's walking into some kind of crazy, corrupt situation. He might get blindsided.
Yeah.
And hilarious. Kilpatrick and McDougal change several colors, you know, and they have some significant looks. And like the FBI is like, well, do you need to tell us something? And Kilpatrick volunteers that, you know, I don't know him personally, but I see his name keep coming up and I have him on a phone call when we saw that last episode where they can tap the phones at the jail about him being a possible dirty cop. So they're like, you know what? Let's hold off a couple weeks and see what comes up. Fucking good decision. But as they'll reflect later in this episode, this almost blew up the whole investigation before it even began.
Yeah. And I do wonder, isn't there some talk in this scene of maybe stopping him from taking over the task force? Isn't that a thing?
I wasn't sure if they were, or they're just giving a heads up so that he, because it's, I mean, imagine if you do have, because she said, well, he's a cowboy, maybe colors outside the law, but he's certainly not corrupt. Imagine if you have this hero cop that's about to take over this corrupt and you know, he's going to get he's like, just by association, you know, he's going to be the head of this thing. I don't know that they were blocking him. It's more of like giving him a heads up. Maybe he wants a pass. Maybe he wants to pass
it
over.
The guy from the FBI. It's the FBI.
Yeah.
The tall one with the glasses or whatever. I thought he suggested, like, after McDougal and Kilpatrick said, hey, this guy is probably dirty, that he suggested, like, oh, do we, like, take him off the task force? Or do we? And then they said, well, let's give it 2 weeks and see what we can turn up.
I don't think that they would have the authority to take him off, or maybe is it wave him off? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I think
not.
Also, like, when we say the FBI, it's like, I think that guy is the federal attorney assigned to case. So he's like the prosecutor, and there's like, you know, it's a law and order, you know?
Sure.
I don't think. Sure. Yeah. So you got the FBI agents are essentially the cops in the situation. And the tall guy with glasses is the guy who's going to be making this case to a federal judge.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just think it's funny. It's one of those cases where later you'll hear this Detective Ward be propound with this question of like, how did you not know? How did you not know? How did you not know? And I think the scene is to back up his assertion of like, look, yeah, I heard of Wayne Jenkins, but it was only in terms of like, man, this fucker is badass. He gets the arrest, he gets the drugs, he gets the guns, and he gets them the right way. Not like, oh man, I want to be on Wayne, so he's going to be the dirty guy, he's going to turn on the money spigot. That even the FBI agents, like from what little they knew, thought that he was like this golden boy.
Yeah. I did expect, I expected more of McDougal in this show, since we started off with him and the Shropshire investigation. We haven't seen him, like you said, in several episodes. I assume at some point they're going to join up, right? Like the Shropshire investigation and like all the BT Tower or BT, I forget what it is, Baltimore Towers?
Belvedere.
BT, whatever. Belvedere. All that's got to come together with Jenkins' investigation, right?
Yeah, I think that they might come in as like the low level police officers that are giving testimony about, because like the federal investigators have to build a case of like, well, how did the feds get involved? This is not even a state. This is a local matter. You know, how did the chain? So they have to they'll be crucial for laying that like initial, you know, like, yeah, well, you know, like what is the probable cause of the FBI coming in and kicking in the door of the Baltimore Police Department and saying, you know, raid essentially. Mm hmm. So we're going to flashback all the way to 2010. Jenkins explaining that he's got a feeling. He's got a special feeling about something. And his feeling is these fellas are driving and they're black. Let's follow the case. They're black. They got a too nice a car. They're not school age. And one guy's got a backpack. That equals drug dealer.
Turns out, yeah, that's the profile that Jenkins has worked up on people, I guess.
And this scene starts to call in the question, is that just a super cop instinct profile he's got going? Or is that just a situation where he like makes it right? Because they engage in a high speed chase through some pretty nice neighborhoods. Not that any neighborhood is so shitty that it can sustain a 90 mile an hour police chase through it. But like, you know, these are the type of houses the kids are going to be running in and out of into the street. And I'm like, especially when the central command is like, call off, do not break off this engagement, and Wayne's like, fuck this, flooring it. I thought it's like something terrible is going to happen, and they end the bad guys, quote unquote, blow through an intersection, clip some person that turns out to be an elderly man and woman driving. And I thought it was, this is the telling thing, is like Wayne and his police officers go up to the car that they are following, and like only as an afterthought did they investigate the civilians that got caught up in this. One of them that will later die.
And when they first roll up on these guys, they're all in plain clothes. They've got highly tinted windows with these lights that kind of barely shine through them when they turn them on, because they're in, you know, not marked cars either, unmarked cars. Right. You could be forgiven in a city like Baltimore, where the crime rate is very high, for people thinking, oh shit, I'm in the middle of something that's going down, let me get the hell out of here, right? Like,
sure.
Not realizing that these are cops in the moment when shit's, when people jump out of vans and point guns at you. And the thing about this is also like, they it's an afterthought for these people who are in this accident, this older man, a woman. The man, I think, is dead, and there's no sign that there's any remorse there, or that, I mean, obviously he doesn't change his habits, right? He probably goes out the very next day and does the same thing over again, not thinking anything of like the consequences of his actions for these people.
Especially all the people are like, man, this car is clean, Sarge. This car is clean. This car.
Yeah, they found nothing. And then they plant that shit on them. And then
Jenkins at the end is like, we'll call the sergeant. And you don't know what's going to happen, but you're going to learn what's going to happen by the end. And to his credits, Wayne is looking a little nervous. Like, oh, God, what have I done? I might have fucked up. But he's going to fix it here. To your point about, like, this is something I've long wondered. When we've got these no-knock, you know, middle-of-the-night warrants where people just, like, bust in the door. Sometimes they say they're cops first. Sometimes they don't. I've often wondered, like, what's going to happen when a very heavily armed country like the United States, like when these cops knock on either the wrong or just, you know, like, it's not that hard to use. Like, you saw our Misery lights. It's not that hard to get a light kit, especially nowadays, to get LEDs and stuff and get that. It's like, I get it that it's illegal. Like, the you can't impersonate an officer. Whole lot of shit in this country is illegal, and it's happening anyway. Like, there's going to be this nightmare situation where a lot of cops get killed in the course they're doing duty, because they've set up, again, these incentives and these to set this stuff in motion. Because somebody rolls up on you in the city, even with bulletproof vests and shit. Like, you can get that stuff off of, you know, a mail order. Like, and we just see it's like, you know, Breonna
Taylor
was like an instance of that, where the cops do the no knock stuff and they get fire got returned. People got killed. I worry that we're in for a lot of that in this next decade. Anyway, the background is that the cops are talking to this detective Ward, they also are going and getting background of other officers. We've seen this one cop, which was one of the police that were with Wayne. We saw him being interviewed, I think, in the police academy in episode one. They're talking to him, and he's explaining how, like, you're not really supposed to chase people in high speed pursuits anymore, unless you've got like a life in danger, and a narcotic stop is not one of those things. This old man was dead on arrival at the hospital. And you see this uniformed sergeant on the scene kind of walk over to the car and give Wayne a significant look. And then seconds later, Wayne says, hey, Sean, Detective Souter, roll over there and check that car one more time. And he finds a big that's the thing. Right. Like, I can't believe how lack of subtlety there is. Like, suddenly there's a big bag of drugs underneath the passenger car seat, something that any cop would have found in 5 seconds.
Yeah, he didn't pull a body panel off or slash open a tire and find a pack of drugs that they missed. It's just sitting there.
Yeah. It just blows my mind that it's kind of like that. And even Souter, it's like this, the things like, you know, I want to say that he's a good cop, probably is a good cop. Like, his alarm bells have to be ringing like crazy on this stuff, right?
Yeah, I think they are. But like, what's he going to do? You know, they found drugs in the guy's car.
Right. So. You're going to be like, oh, you planted this. You planted this way. You're going to start that shit show? Like, yeah. Are you? I don't know. So we begin this interrogation of Mr. Ward, this detective that lately joined the Gun Trace Task Force. And he starts with a statement of remorse. And I guess at the first of the episode, I was primed to be like, this guy's full of shit. And by the end of the episode, I turned around on him. But he's like, seemed to me materially different from the other officers, where it's like he knew this was wrong the whole time and also tried to take steps to shield himself from, try to, again, find that middle ground between narking on his fellow officers and just being a full-on corrupt shitbag.
Yeah, no, he went along to get along. And in a certain way, you can understand that when your livelihood depends on these guys thinking you're okay.
You also mentioned that the brass protected Jenkins in a way that they didn't protect his fellow officers that worked underneath him. What do you think that was about?
Probably because he gets the job done, you know, like he brings in the guns, right? Every time you see Jenkins come in with a bag or something, every cop's like, oh, hit the jackpot again, huh? There's the hero cop. There's the man. And, you know, he does pull guns and drugs off the street. And people like that. And there's a line later about the numbers, right? Like, as long as you keep the numbers up, they don't give a shit what we do.
But that's the thing. It's like, by extension, like, if Wayne gets numbers, don't his men get numbers too? Like, I wondered if there was a racial component, because I've started to notice there is the white guys who are the ones in charge of the task force, and they have a whole bunch of black guys working for them.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there is some kind of like meta level to this where, well, yeah, the white guy can be the hero cop. The other, you know, the bad apples that work for him, man, you know, what are you going to do?
It could be, but I do notice the pattern of like, you know, there's a thing later where Jenkins gets a call from his wife about his kids and has to go deal with something. And he's in the middle of a bust. And he tells one of the other cops, hey, you can have this collar, right? So there's a component of like the person who actually signs the paperwork gets all the credit or something.
Sure, yeah, right.
So Jenkins is a superior of these other guys would be getting that credit, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm
yeah,
not sure.
I just I wonder if they're because like this is I've seen so far the show seems to suggest some hypothesis or raise some concerns that we'll elaborate and illuminate later. So like I wonder if we're going to see more of like because what I've seen so far is Wayne propping his guys up and puffing up, like you said, giving them collars and things like that, sharing the money in a way that the other sergeant maybe didn't. And I'm wondering if like we're going to see where some of that was just for show and behind the scenes, he was like throwing people under the bus. I haven't seen that yet. I don't think so. Yeah. Anyway. So we go to this Belvedere Tower stop, and this is in the spring of 2015. So this is right when Detective Ward joined the task force. It's 2 years before they've been collared because this all happened in 2017. The Fed's starting to roll up this task force. And they roll up on two guys that are just minding their own business, apparently, at the towers. Jenkins walks out and he's got his spiel. I'm a federal officer. We've got wiretaps in the neighborhood. You guys aren't a target, but we know there's a drug dealer deal going down there. We smelled marijuana, so we're allowed to do everything we're about to do, which is toss your car for contrabands and drugs. And if they don't find that, then you'll get to go. But they're also going to rob you. 100% they're going to rob you. And they do. Did you think it was odd that the guy's getting robbed? Like, they took it with a certain level of, like, resignedness that surprised me. Like, they're not even angry about it. It's just like ran up and bit them. Like, fuck, what are you going to do? These fucking dogs in this city.
No, this strikes me as like, I don't know, when fucking Uber gets fined for not classifying their employees correctly or you know, some pharmaceutical company did some improper marketing of their product and they get a fine, right? This is the cost of doing business. Every once in a while, if you're unlucky, some cop is going to roll up, take your shit, and then kick you back out on the street. And then you start over again, right? Like, that's just how it goes.
What do you think about, and this is something I've thought about a lot, about law enforcement's ability to lie to people. I get that part of investigation, you have to kind of play cagey with what you know, what you don't know, what your buddy might know, what your buddy might be telling people. That's effective interrogation. Like once you got someone interrogating them, but like, I don't know how it sits, like people saying, I'm a federal agent. Yeah. We've got wiretaps. We've got like, I don't know where the line should be drawn, but it seems like there's no line. Like a cop can literally tell you anything about your rights and whatever. And to the extent that you rely on them, you're a fool.
Oh yeah, totally.
They don't cover this information.
That's why you have lawyers for this shit. No, of course not.
Right. Right.
No, from everything I know, everything I've been taught in the movies, impersonating a federal agent is a crime. And I don't think that that stops being a crime if you're a police officer.
I wonder what the actual fact of the matter is on that, because it's like we were talking about with Souter last week, you know, to some extent, he took advantage of Ebony's lack of knowledge of her rights to clear a gun murder off the street, which is a good thing. But on the other hand, you've got now, this is the shadowy side where you've got a person saying, hey, you know, this is essentially, don't worry, you know, we're federal, don't worry about your right. And the guy's even saying, like, I'm not consenting to any of this searching. And it doesn't fucking matter. Yeah. Because all a cop's got to say is, I smelled weed. Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. The probable cause, like every time they talk about probable cause in the show, I laugh because they're laughing. Like there is no such thing as probable cause in this scenario.
Yeah.
They don't need it.
So they rob these guys. They pull up a couple of blocks. They stop and Wayne checks for a GPS tracker because he's not an idiot. He doesn't want to get caught. He divides up the money in a way that's kind of unfair. And he's like, well, look, I'm going to buy a crash bar with this money. This is going to go back to my squad car. And then he gives them essentially money laundering 101. Don't be smart with this. Don't put it in a bank. Don't pay off any major bills with it. Trickle it out a little bit of a time. Buy, you know, like
steaks and beer. Just go one shelf up on your beer and one grade up on your beef.
Yeah, no, he turns into De Niro from Goodfellas.
Yeah, like, totally.
Don't, I don't want to see you guys in Impalas and fur coats next weekend, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ward, we see him put his share back. Like, he's like, hey, I got to do something. He puts it back because he doesn't want this money. And he explains that his wife, that they got a service family. His wife is a member of the Baltimore Police Department, and she's squeaky clean. And he was scared and uncomfortable taking the cash. And the guy clarifies, are you comfortable taking the cash with that? He's like, no, we're going to tax drug dealers when we get them on the street. But like, this is a whole other level.
It's too much. Yeah.
Yeah. But it just goes to show you that like the system, like the mild graft and greed and corruption enables the big stuff. And there's a quote in the Bible, like faith, the one who is faithful in least is faithful in much. And I do believe that, you know, like if you're the type of guy that's going to take $500 off a suspect because you can, you're probably going to be the guy that takes 10 grand out of a safe house when you find it.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe there should be more stings. Maybe there should be more stings from within the police department. I hear those are not entrapment.
Like, it sounds like IED is incompetent based on this show, but who knows? Or that their recommendations just aren't even followed, right? Like, they talk about that later.
So the investigators are contemplating the amorality of Jenkins' actions when Ward's like, I can actually top that, and retells a story of them going to a strip club, of Wayne Jenkins becoming enamored with a certain dwarf stripper and him taking the opportunity because he can to rob her, go into the VIP with lures of paying for sex, and he actually just straight up robs her. And the men have a reaction to it. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah. I mean, they think it's wrong, and it is wrong. I don't know what else to say about it.
But it shows the men here have reached their limit, and they're like, this is fucked up, man. And they try to tell it in the mildest form possible, but like Jenkins has a way of shutting it down, being like, hey, man, he's like, I can't believe you just robbed the M-slur stripper. And Jig's like, hey, man, no, don't put it like that. Like, well, right. How else the fuck do you want to put it, man?
Yeah, that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, this is like bully shit, even to the point where these professional bullies are uncomfortable. And, you know, again, the investigator's like, how did you not know about this guy? And he's like, this was a fucked up night, but you got to understand that his numbers are what I knew him from. He was a legend. Right. He owned these streets. He'd been working at this point 10 years plainclothes. Who the fuck was he? A new guy on the squad, newly promoted. Who was he to be like, hey, this is a bunch of bullshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
2012. Herschel has pulled over a guy in a candy Impala who we just, I think it's interesting that in the first episode, we meet a civilian who has one of these things because he works hard and he provides for his family. And they got this poor guy out on the curb and they're parading their dirt, you know, going through his shit. And Wayne pulls up with the sergeant stripes and puts on a show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you imagine being this guy on the curb?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking in this scene. Just like, and he vocalizes it at the end. He's like, man, this is bullshit.
It's like, you know, when you go into like a bad McDonald's and there's like trash everywhere and like the toilets are backed up with shit and the employees are kind of like having a celebration about like how this place is terrible. And, you know, it's like that's kind of galling if you're just there for your chicken nuggets, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But to see this stuff from police officers, it's wild. It's wild.
Yeah, and the whole time it's like he's having a celebratory drink as he pulls up.
He's in his
squad car. Like to I don't know, man. It's just like this show just keeps presenting me with this guy and these people over and over again. And every time I see them, it's more cringy. I don't know. I don't know what to think.
Yeah, there was something like I remember watching the original Wire and kind of like or opening my eyes when you'd see Bunk and McNulty get knee knocking, eyes crossed, stumbling drunk at the end of their shifts and then pile into their cars and drive off and think, God, this is fucking crazy. And I think that this is like, again, it all builds, right? Like this disrespect, basic disrespect and thinking that you're above the law in mm-hmm. little things. It's like, you know, these guys are seeing some fucked up shit, you know, babies in microwaves and 30 women asphyxiated in cargo containers over sex. Like, and then they got to be able to blow off a little steam, right? They got to build the team exercises. But that little corruption leads, that snowballs into what you've got now. Because it's the same fucking city we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We just celebrate Happy Wayne Jenkins Day in 2012, him getting his stripes. And we go to 2014 in the middle of action. Guys screaming, why did you have to run him over, Wayne? Wayne instructing, go find a gun in the yard. He has put these crash bars to use and he's run someone off the road, run them over because he says that the guy pointed a gun at him. We're going to find out that there was no gun involved. And he makes another call saying, I need you to bring me a piece because the shift commander is about here. The shift commander gets out, is not looking very impressed. They interview the shift commander. And the interesting thing is that he did report all this. We found that in the very first episode, that he had put this and the FBI had even talked to him about it and it went nowhere. I do wonder, we're going to have to, there's got to have to be some corruption at the FBI level, right?
Yeah. I mean, all this corruption seems to be trickling up, right? You look at, is it Allers who gets promoted out of that into the DEA?
Yep.
Yeah, you see all these guys who are corrupt just moving up and up and up, right?
Because they're superstars. They get promoted.
Right. Yeah.
And then they cover for everybody who was their acolytes and their trainees.
Uh-huh. I think we are going to have to see more of this, and it probably does go higher than they think. The other thing, though, is I think there's a limit to this stuff, and I think Jenkins is pushing it, because you can see when he calls in his superior, whoever this guy is, to drop off this gun and stash it so they could find it. He's like annoyed with him, right? Because he was in the middle of doing something else, and Jenkins is like, I need this. Like, yeah, I'm in deep shit here.
Right.
So this guy is not going to put up with this shit forever from Jenkins, but, you know, he's putting it up with it enough to get Jenkins off the hook.
Well, it seems like an escalation, too, because this is pretty egregious. Like, I'm just going to, like, I'm going to give this guy a federal gun charge because Jenkins bet wrong on his backpack. And at the end of the scene, Jenkins like, well, I owe you a favor. What is going to be the fucked up thing that he calls Jenkins to help him with? That's going to be maybe a little bit over the line from what Jenkins is comfortable with. And it just keeps going. It seems like it's a story where it just keeps going back and forth. And like, well, if you're going to call bullshit on my thing, like, what about you robbing the stripper? What about you play? And this also shows up this kabuki kind of thing that they do where they know they did something dirty and they let the uniformed officers who are not part of the task force find the gun. And then Wayne comes up and like, you know, whoa, back off, everybody. Let's wait for evidence collection to come in. We want to do this right by the book. Like, there's something extra cynical and circle of hell about how cynical they're manipulating the system.
Right.
We then see the feds reviewing a video of Jenkins at a car stop where he searches this car for over 60 minutes. He stays with the perp for that long, interrogating him in multiple positions. The tape runs out and bingo bongo, drugs show up after it was thoroughly tossed by several seasoned police officers. Turns out, yes, he's probably underneath the floor mat, you know, rookie mistake.
Yeah.
You gotta check the floor mats. And they found 7 ounces of coke, which is a shit ton of coke. This isn't like, you know, a little dime baggie that slipped between the crack of the seat. And it contradicts the arrest record that he wrote up. So the charges got dropped and he was referred to the IAED. And we see an inset of him sweating with this IAED officer. And the lady's like, your arrest record does not match the video evidence. And Wayne's like, well, I found it after the video. I just wrote it up wrong. Trust me, I can talk to the prosecutor. I can make this right. And, you know, he doesn't. And the federal investigators are talking to Warden's like, well, how the fuck did he get out of this? And he goes, well, let me tell you, Freddie Gray happened. And they recounts a story of Wayne's quote unquote heroism during the hours that Baltimore is burning. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you something, Jim. How much is this Wayne being just like the pro cop, super cop, and this is what he would do anyway? And how much of this is him turning it up a little extra because he knows IAD is breathing down his throat and he wants his brothers and sisters on the thin blue line remembering who's buttering their bread?
It's probably a little of both. The thing that strikes me about it, though, is what a change of attitude he has as soon as he shows up to this literal thin blue line at the protests.
And yeah, he's
I don't know if we're ready to talk about that yet, but
yeah, we're ready to talk about the whole thing, like through him robbing the Rite Aid, if you want.
Okay, yeah. So he shows up, right? He goes out. He gets all his cop buddies together. Is like all gung ho. We're gonna go out here and we're gonna defend this city. We're gonna put this down, right? And
warrior.
He
cops.
Gets out there, grabs a shield. A guy throws a rock at him. They get into a slight altercation, and then he gets back on the line. And he looks shaken, right? Like, and I don't know if it's mentally shaken here, like, well, it's mentally for sure. But is it like emotionally, like he realizes that this is sort of like a direct result? These are the consequences of his actions coming home to roost. Or is this?
Yeah.
Fuck. I'm actually like, I'm fine when I'm ripping and rolling people on the streets and stealing cash out of powerless people's hands. But when there's people fighting back, I'm not actually the tough guy I think I am. I can't tell which is which here.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just saw a video from last week. You know, the Supreme Court got a leaked document that has implications for life here in America, and people were pissed about it, and they're out in the streets. And I saw this was footage, I think, from the Washington, D.C. area. There'd been a flash protest at the nation's capital, and Department of Homeland Security police pulled up. It was two guys in a squad car, two people who were just kind of milling around. And this one guy grabbed a 65-year-old lady who was, you know, wearing Roe v. Wade gear and just apropos of nothing said, back off, and then shoved her hard. And this 65-year-old lady, white lady, was like, fucking game on. I kind of came here hoping for shit like this. And this guy just started shoving people, and this officer behind him who had a submachine gun started grabbing him, and like you could see them become aware of the fact that they are two guys against now like 60 people who are fucking incensed at the way they're behaving, and they end up having to abandon their squad car and like flee on foot. Mm-hmm. I do think that like there is this kind of like where the cop mentality hits reality of like, oh shit, what if we did have to go to war against this city? We'd fucking get our asses kicked.
Yeah.
Especially in places like Baltimore and some of these other, you know, the urban areas where they've just been doing this shit for a generation or two. Yeah, man, I don't know. Cause like, I thought he looked afraid too. And you saying like, maybe if he's got enough self-awareness to like, this is all the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah. I think it's less of that. Cause I don't think he's super self-aware like that, or he is in, I don't know. He is in moments, right? Like when the guy he calls in to plant the gun is telling him like, this is it, man, you fucking cashed in your last card. He kind of gets that look on his face. Like, oh, maybe I've gone too far here. That there's the stuff where he's sitting in jail in 2017 or whenever it is, where you look at him and go, okay, now he's thinking about all the consequences. Like, he understands all of this led here, right? Like,
but I think you're right too, that like, why would he? Because that first instance where he beat that guy outside of his apartment and his superiors calls like, man, you could lose your job over this, Wayne. You could tell Wayne is sweating bullets. He's like, oh, I fucked up.
Right.
But it became a joke. And then we've seen him iterate this so many times. Like, and like that Herschel guy gets off on 50 complaints. Why would they ever think that that there's ever going to be consequences to this? You know, if you let people off without any, it seems like it really, you know, ruins they expect consequences. They don't get it. And then they take that into the next interaction.
Yeah, it teaches them, right? Like, it teaches them that there aren't consequences. And what lesson do you expect them to learn from that?
And we also see like Detective Souter's perspective, because he's like, they're suiting up everybody in the blues, and they want everybody in their class A uniforms with shields and riots. And Souter's like, fuck, what about, you know, I'm murder police now and I'm going to be banging heads. He goes up to the major, who we saw was doing a house cat desk duty in the last episode, and they're burning a police car. And Souter's like, are we just not going to do anything? And the major's like, man, fuck that car. At this point, just let him blow off steam. And there's this kind of like, the good apple cops are like, well, shit, are we just going to let the city burn? Because if we try to go and restore justice, we're all going to get, we're just going to make things worse. And then Jenkins bringing the six, he buys on his own dime 600 meals, delivers them with his assault minivan that he's got this cowcatcher bolted to the front of, and just living it up. You know, he is, to all these officers, he is the embodiment of everything that's good about being a Baltimore police.
So and this is also a cop out from him. Like, he got on that line. He took a couple of shots from a brick
to escalating his shield, the situation.
Got scared, went out, bought chicken for the squad, and stood back while the other cops handled the being on the line.
Right.
Like, he literally won't put himself on the line here. This is his way of chickening out. And I found it hilarious that he's delivering chicken to cops while chickening out on actually doing the thing that would help here. But I know cops got to eat also, but also he puffs himself up constantly. Like, he's the badass going to run in there and bust some heads. Right.
He's the guy.
And here he is serving chicken off the back of a truck. Get fucked, dude.
He's the guy flying in, beating on his officer's legs because he's wearing Air Jordans. Like, he's just,
but that's when six officers are dogpiling one dude. Right.
It's
when
it's extremely like 60, performative, right?
Yeah. It's so performative.
Yeah. So then you've got the next scene is the officers at their command post watching a TV of the state's attorney, Mosby, who we've talked about, throwing the book at the Freddie Gray officers involved in the transport and his arrest. And from the officer's perspective, and you can see, like, even from a legal perspective, they're like, well, if you want to give negligence to the guy who drove the car, who ended up giving Freddie Gray the rough ride that led to his death, okay. But murder with a depraved heart, like, they're essentially saying, okay, you caught us, but, like, no one intended, like, we wanted Freddie Gray to get busted up, but we didn't want him to die. And, like, that's not murder. Like, that doesn't meet the standard of murder right there. And they're probably right. Like, I remember.
That's the thing, yeah.
I remember everyone being so excited. This Mosby person was like holding the cops accountable. She's throwing the book at him. But you charge people for murder that means something, and it's not murder. And the thing is, it's confusing, is I think that you and I can see situations where we wouldn't intend to kill something. It was all supposed to be harmless, but we would be charged for negligent homicide or something like that because we're just people. And people cannot be aware of the law and get in trouble for it. And people can be held accountable for what reasonable people might conclude would happen if you put a person in this situation, you know. But cops don't. They have this thing called qualified immunity, which if they just kind of happen to believe they're doing the right thing in a stressful cop situation, then it's ipso facto legal. And you can't hold them responsible for not understanding how their duties and responsibilities kind of like overlay each other.
Which is crazy because they've been to school for this stuff, right? That's like an engineer's bridge falling down and said, well, you can't hold me responsible for not knowing that it wouldn't hold up to natural forces. No, that's what you're paid to do, man.
Yeah, you're holding the layper people more responsible than for the law than the people who are trained and enforce it.
Right. Seems crazy.
But you also see him starting to do like this. Well, we got to go out there. We got to get money. We got to raise money for these guys' legal protections. And they cut to this guy saying, so there's not just one Wayne Jenkins. Like, they're wanting to be like, this guy's a corrupt dirtbag that's doing this and that. And I think throughout this episode, he's showing how other officers who might be just like him and hear this guy, he gets drugs off the street, he gets guns off the street, he makes big busts, he makes good arrests, he is a hero cop that's the first to the line, that's the first to defend us, that's the first to raise money for when we're getting fucked over by, a state's attorney trying to grandstand, trying to become district attorney. It's a narrative, right? And it seems like it is really effective with the rank and file.
And I found it very ironic that some of this money that they're going to pull in for donations is going to directly be money taken from people on the streets who were innocent and just had their shit stolen from them.
Yeah. I mean, you start putting these numbers together. Like, remember when they talked about how many stops the cops made in like a 5-year period and like less than 1% of 1% of those were actually. And you think about, okay, that's already like, I'm hot if I'm just driving in my neighborhood and I get pulled over 8 different times in the course of a year because, whatever. But now you wonder what percentage of those people got robbed. And it ain't zero.
100% of the people who had something to rob.
Yeah. The number's not zero. It's not 1% of 1%. It's a lot. So it's like, those are staggering numbers. So the next vignette we get treated to is what Ward calls a jackpot, that they've done some police work. They've got this guy pulled over. They find him with a half key of coke and a weapon on him. They call the squad. They find out that he's got a legit listed address. What an idiot. They get a search warrant and they go in and they find a shit ton of drugs and a giant safe that they subsequently bust open. The criminal informant that they were acting on said there's 100,000. There's substantially more, enough to get every officer 20 grand and then Wayne to get an even bigger payday off that. And they set this up like a movie set. Wayne's like, okay, we got to cover our asses here. I want you guys, like, down to like, I want you to get your cameras out, all synchronized, say action like they do in the movies. And they put the 100,000 in the busted up safe. They stage it like they're rebusting into the safe. And then Wayne comes in there. He's like, is there more than 5,000 in here? Holy shit. We got to call the feds because that's what you got to do. You got to take it, you know, and like, we're going to do another one of these seizures by the book.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. This is the type of shit that always on body cameras are meant to stop. One of the things, you know, but you can't do that on plainclothes officers. You can't do that on the guys who are out there. Yeah, it's just not possible, right?
But they do, because like I've seen some of these guys with the... Go ahead.
Oh, have you?
No, yeah, like I said that, like in like episode, I think, 3, half of Wayne's crew had body cameras on them, including Herschel, of all people. And half of, so I like, I'm not sure what the rules are of when you got to wear them, when you don't. And this is in this is in 2015. So yeah, maybe that happened after Freddie Gray, the body cameras. I don't know.
I'm not sure. Yeah. But I don't know. It would prevent this type of stuff.
Or it'd help at least. You would see, it'd be easier to see. You'd think, I don't know. Because I feel like if you put body cameras on this system with this personnel, they would figure out a way, you know, the whole department would check clocked out to take a shit in the 5 minutes that they beat the fuck out of somebody, you know, and the cameras would come back on. We all ran out of the boys' room, saw this guy committing a crime and he's all bloody in his hand, but it's cool. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the people that were supposed to be like, if IAD is supposed to be watching this stuff and their supervisors are supposed to be like, they're going to be like, well, you know, it's department procedure that these boys were all taking a synchronized shit. What are you going to do? Their colon synchronized after they've been on the force, you know, rolling out with each other.
And there's a scene earlier, right, where Wayne has one of the guys move their car so that the security camera can't get a look at them stealing the money out of these guys' cars, trunks.
Right. Putting the clinic.
So they do find ways around it.
They do. So they said, did anyone complain about Wayne taking more than his fair share? And the cop's like, no, because he was the guy for, you know, he had his methods and they were flawed, but they also paid off a lot more than they didn't. And you know, they were kind of happy that they took a big drug dealer off the street, and they asked him what he did with his money. He's like, I had time to think about it. I got to my house. I thought about my family. And I dumped the 20 grand in a vacant lot in Baltimore. And they asked him why. What did you make of this guy's reasons, his motivation?
I mean, that made a lot of sense, right? You know, it's too much money to just bring home and use and still have your wife stay clean. And going along to get along makes a certain amount of sense in this situation. What do you do?
Yeah, I wonder if these officers had wives that were also police officers that were clean. Like, how much harder would their job be? Because at some point, I got to think a lot of these like Wayne Jenkins' wife has to know something's up, right?
I would assume. I don't know. I mean, it depends on how open they are. But I don't get the impression that they're very open with each other. Or, you know.
And also, like, so the next scene is a team building exercise in 2016 where Wayne is taking over the gun trace task force and he's talking about his vision to the men. And he talks about how what motivates a police officer is money, which, fair enough, it motivates anybody. And they compare about what they're taking in. And this makes me feel like an idiot for talking about maybe we should pay these guys more. Because they're talking about getting a base pay of like 75 grand, making 62 off overtime. And again, I think these cops only work 4 days. They consider 4 days a week full time. So this isn't like them working 75, 80 hours. This is them working probably 60, 65, which was probably an average week for me when I was working white collar programming. Yeah. And they're making $150,000 to $175,000 and carrying a gun and beating the fuck out of whoever they want. You got to think, like, why wasn't this enough?
Right.
You could provide for a family in Baltimore for $170,000. Absolutely.
Like I said, that there's an opportunity there and these guys are opportunistic. That's what it is. That's what it basically comes down to. They are making enough. It's just, you can always make more. And if the opportunity is there to do it and no one's going to stop you from doing it, of course these guys are going to do that.
And he talks about how it's going to, they're like, the gun trace task force is even going to get worse, quote unquote, because they're going to work 8 to 4, but they're going to show up at 2. But in mm-hmm. those 2 hours of police work, they're going to get so much guns and so much drugs that no one's even going to care that they're doing clock theft now. So they're going to work. They're going to work 8 hours a week, get $150 a year for it, and own the city. Like they shout out the name of the episode or name of the series here. And we end this thing where, like, if you have any doubt about what Detective Ward's telling you, they have $20,000 sitting forlornly to this day in an empty lot in Baltimore.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if that's going to be a smoking gun. A small smoking gun, right? Not like a 45. It'd probably be like a 9mm against Jenkins. Because, that certainly like backs up the story that Ward's telling here.
I thought you mentioned the symbolism of the chickens. I wonder if there's symbolism with that they choose Grant on the 50 looking balefully at us from the stack of, because like, you know, what Ulysses Grant is famous for a couple things, winning the Civil War by throwing Union lives at Lee until he ran out. And also presiding over one of the most corrupt and graft ridden parts of U.S. federal history. I wonder if like he's kind of like the poster child for, and I don't think Grant himself is corrupt. I'm just saying that he happened to be the president that was overseeing just tons and tons of truly heinous corruption, probably because it's after Civil War and there's a lot of profiteering, carpetbagging, etc. But I wondered if that there was a little bit, because I would think, you know, you'd have a bit, you know, you'd have Franklin or, you know, Jackson looking out after from the 20 or the 100 to 50. I thought was an interesting choice.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that, but could be.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
That's the bulk of the episode. We do have a little bit of other stuff that I want to talk about. Let's talk about Nicole Steele. Her office is doing a deep dive on these officers who can't take the stand, this list. And we learn about the history of that. This was a formal list that was sent as a complaint to the Baltimore Police Department, and it was done nothing with. So now it's just something that prosecuting attorneys circulate to keep their cases, to keep wasting time on cases that are going to get thrown out of court, essentially. And it's not just a list. It actually has details, specifics, known examples of perjury. And she says, I want to see a man answer a straight question. She takes her partner to meet with Commissioner Davis and ask, why are these guys still on the street? These are names with actionable concerns. And he explains this goes back three commissioners ago to a commissioner and a state's attorney fighting. One was pissed that I'm taking all these crime and I'm bringing it to your desk and you're not prosecuting. The state's attorney pissed that you're giving me piss poor casework that is not getting prosecutions. And instead of working on that problem, they just kind of go to this cold war where they ignore all criticisms leveled at each other.
Yeah, which is okay. That's the setup. Now you've got the list. Now you're the police commissioner, and I'm 100% with Nicole. My very first question is, why can't you do something about it right now?
That's the history, but now you've got actionable stuff. Why? So, like, she's starting to peel, like, well, this Davis guy is like, oh, my hands are tied, all this history. But, like, yeah, what keeps you from cleaning your side of the street?
Mm-hmm.
And then from that newly cleaned street, you could launch more effective attacks against the state's attorney who's, you know, got their sidewalks all shitted up. I don't think there's a good answer for that question.
No, I agree. There isn't. And I forget his name, but the guy who's working under Nicole is just like, oh, yeah, good point.
And then we also see in a flashback, Nicole Steele walking the Freddie Gray protest. This is in the day, you know, like after, where things are a little bit more calm and contained. They reference these 300 T-shirts. There was this organization in Baltimore that started where it's kind of a dual reference to Sparta, the 300 that stood alone against, and also the fact that 300 bodies are the average in Baltimore. And these guys would essentially wear these black T-shirts and form a line between the protesters and the police to kind of like keep the violence to a minimum. Like they were trained to never respond to any provocation. So they would kind of like, because God knows the police can't de-escalate shit. God knows the angry protesters and rioters axiomatically wouldn't be de-escalating shit. So they tried. And her just kind of like, you know, like the difference in perspective for someone kind of like outside looking in at this crazy stuff. We have a little bit of Detective Sean Suter to talk about, which is, I think, this is the case that he's bringing to trial with the prosecutor about this gun charge. And he's seeing the prosecutor trying to impanel a jury. And white guy who got beat for attending a Black Lives Matter, a black guy who got beat for trying to deliver baby diapers to his sister who just gave birth. And they're both saying, like the one guy, the memorable line, I wouldn't believe a Baltimore Police Department officer if he told me his mother loved him. And just systematically, the judge dismissing these people and saying, does anyone else have any concerns? And like half of the court raises their hands. And at the end of the day, out of 180 jurists considered, only 8 made it to the to the actual panel.
Right. This is the problem.
So Souter's done great police work with his good police, and it's probably going to amount to nothing. And how do you be good police in the face of that? And the prosecutor makes a point. It's like, you guys have beaten and locked up so many people for bullshit that we can't find 12 people in this city to dispense justice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another detail from the Wayne Jenkins story that, again, this was outside the perspective of, I don't think this is things that the investigators know about yet. This is might be things that would shock even Wayne Jenkins' men. Wayne has got this pipeline with the bail bonds guy. Do you want to describe it? Like what this arrangement is?
He seems to be bringing him certain types of drugs that he likes in exchange for payments because, you know, he feels inferior to his other cop buddies who are been on the force longer, making more money, doing all the dirty stuff that he's doing just a little more successfully. So, he's trading drugs for money here.
And this is 2013 Wayne Jenkins. This is Wayne Jenkins with base out, sergeant's base salary of 85 grand. Who's getting the overtime?
Overtime of who's another getting
the
80.
Who's getting the, you know, the 5, 10, 20 grand out of the safes.
Right.
But there's still like the drugs. Well, what do you do with the drugs? I got to turn all that into evidence, man. Like 5 kilo. Mm-hmm. Why can't I do something? I turn in 1 kilo and turn in 40. And
yeah, the
they
glee
are,
is astounding. Astounding.
Yeah. And we didn't even address the thing. While he's doing his hero cop shit during the Freddie Gray riots, he also robs a riot. He stops two guys from robbing a Rite Aid and then essentially takes their, you know, they probably hit and got all the good drugs out into garbage bags. He's able to benefit from that to the point where like the bail bond guys, like it feels like the banks in Miami at mid-stage a Scarface where they're like, we can't launder $100 million, yeah, man. Like we have rules that we have to follow. You are so out of, and the bail bond guy's kind of like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with all these loose bills? And Wayne's like, LOL, sell it.
Yeah. So I think it's worse than that too, because I think what happens here is when these guys come running out of this Rite Aid or whatever with these two big bags, Jenkins picks them up after he chases them off, picks up the bags, and goes back inside. I don't know that he necessarily just took what he had there. I think he went and actually looted that place himself. Picked out the OxyContins, picked out the high-priced pills. Because when he goes to his bail bonds guy says, these are worth a shitload of money.
Right.
So I think he went in and handpicked the ones that he knew were worth a lot.
You might be right. You actually might be right, because he did the big show of like, I don't even know what any of this stuff is, but yet.
The last time we see him, he's walking back into the place with the bags. What would he be doing that for?
And this is how stupid I was at the beginning of the scene. I'm like, why the fuck would you rob a right? Like, what are you going to get? Like greeting cards and shit. I forgot that, yes, they have all these narcotics back and you could force the safe open. And yeah, so... That's all the crime and corruption that we've uncovered in this hour of television.
All I can stand for this week. Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck. We do have some feedback. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Feedback. If you'd like to send us feedback, send it to corners@baldmove.com. First up is Devon Winston. He says, I'm a big fan of all your content. I'm actually listening to your Breaking Bad podcast again for the third time, three times through.
It's a charm.
Back in the simple old days where an old man was trying to cook drugs for his family, you know, simpler, less morally ambiguous days. I'm from New York City, which goes without saying is a horribly policed city, but I have an idea how we can get the ball rolling on stopping police from going down the path of darkness. Not sure if it even work or how it would work, but law enforcement is a business with employees, and employees have pensions. Whenever the police department gets sued and has to pay that money, it comes from the city's budget. But how about whenever a police department gets sued and they lose, what if the money were to come out of the police pension fund? Last I checked, the NYPD pension fund was just short of $54 billion. If I were a cop and that caused a situation ends up being a $4 million lawsuit, and imagine that money comes out of the pension fund, I'd assume I'd get nothing but dirty looks and shit assignments from the department. Who wants to be the asshole that causes the pension fund to lose millions? Anyway, just a half-baked thought. If you guys read this, I'd like to hear your thoughts. Keep up the good work.
So this, I think that's kind of a good idea. Here's what I would worry about in that scenario is that they would use this as an excuse to just get theirs. Like, well, if there's not going to be a pension for me because it keeps getting sucked away by these... you know, obviously wrong charges. Like, no, nobody did the shit they said, right? Like, this whole thing is bullshit anyway. Cops are going to be inclined to be like, well, I got to get mine while I'm out here because it's not going to be there for me afterward. So I think there might be some potential for some, you know, incentives to do the opposite of what you actually want there.
Right. And there's also...
But it does seem like a good idea on the face of it, certainly.
Yeah. There's also like group punishment, like, you know, what about the officers are not doing anything?
But
they're being
Yeah, but that incentivizes them to blow the whistle on these fools, right?
It does. I like that. The bigger mm-hmm. problem is, like, you would have to get the union to agree to this.
Oh, right. And that would be an impossible task.
The problem
task.
With these, like, any public union, even things I kind of wholeheartedly support, like teachers' unions, it's one thing if, like, everybody at Ford walks off and it hurts Ford, the company. When mm-hmm. you have like teachers that just refuse to teach because they're trying to negotiate a contract, you're hurting a city's worth of children, for example. If you have cops that just walk off the job, like that could cause people's lot. So they have the disproportionate power. Fire department's another one, but they just say, hey, you know, like, what? We don't like our contract. We're going to not respond to bells anymore.
Right.
I know there's restrictions like for them literally doing that, but we've also seen in this episode how effective cops can just like, you know, not do anything, just sit in their patrol cars and not do something. I don't know how you would wrest that concession from the police. I wonder if you could structure it like a bonus. Like there is a potentially X amount of bonus pay that officers get each year, and we're going to pay our civil rights penalties out of that. So this is a new thing you're negotiating in the union. Like there's going to be a budget, and we're going to and everybody will get this, and it's going to divvy up by blah 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 blah, and the pool of that is going to shrink every time we have one of this because we're going to pay out of that.
Yeah, I mean there's still that the problem of the incentive that might create for cops to, you know, go out there and get their own.
Right. Well, they're going to take it from us anyway. We got to get ours. Yeah.
Right. I've seen that mentality time and time again with people. But I don't know. I mean, yeah, we got to do something. I don't think that's the worst suggestion. I think, yeah, maybe the bonus pay stuff, maybe some positive reinforcement, you know, incentivize people to come forward with complaints about officers, incentivize other officers to do the right thing. But it's tough because if you're already making $170K a year,
right,
what's another, you get $1,000 for like a tip on another officer that the IAD prosecutes on or something, like,
right,
or is able to get a prosecution on. I don't know. That's why we say, like, when we're looking for this show to say something about a possible solution, it's because these aren't easy things to solve, and I feel like we don't have a lot of great ideas on ways to solve them.
No, it's a tricky problem. The problem is like, not only are we not doing anything solving, it doesn't seem like we're doing anything to, because like, to me, the rot all starts with vice crime. Like there's a long history of when you try to outlaw stuff that everybody's like maybe morally dubious about, but like, it's not murder, it's not rape, it's not arson, it's gambling, it's drugs.
Yeah, there's not a lot of upside to the murder investigations, right?
Right.
There isn't everyone, a bunch of money or drugs to be had to sell. It's
sure. And like, you can't find support for like murder that you can for like, you know, I want to go to the track and bet some money this weekend, or I want to be able to buy a fifth of vodka and get kerblastered this weekend, or I want to get an eight, you know, like they're like a lot of people like on that stuff. And I just, like we saw our country burn when we outlawed liquor. And I know there'll be problems with like free availability or decriminalization of drugs, but holy shit, look at what the alternative has been for the last 50 years.
Yeah, those are easier problems to solve, right? If we can de-escalate the problem that we have to solve, we might actually have a chance of solving it.
It's ruining our police. And it's ruining our laws and institutions. Like, it's one thing to have, you know, like you got an opium den in your neighborhood and, oh, my God, it's causing problems because this, that and the other. You could do stuff with zoning and police enforcement and stuff about, you know, like a strip club's legal and there's shootouts in a strip club parking lot. You can prosecute that crime without prosecuting the stripping. And it seems like that as long as we have this stuff where like, because a cop, like, if you look the other way in a murder, I think other cops like, whoa, fuck. You look the other way in a drug bust, it's not the same. It's just not. So I don't have any hope as long as we give these cops this shitty mission, you know?
Yeah, what you're saying is in the drug war.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a huge part of it.
Eric C, I think he's responding to us talking about search and seizure, and us, like, you know, the fact that if you and I were to drive around at $15,000 and we got stopped, we'd have our money stolen. He goes, no offense, Aaron, but I suspect a white man of $15,000 in your car may get afforded some benefit of the doubt a black man would not. You're wrong.
Yeah.
I might not get my trunk searched, but if they were to search my car and they found $15,000, my white ass is not walking out of it. And the other thing is, like, I think that this is something white folks need to realize is if you are out in the rural area of this country and you're a white person and you're poor, you are the black man and woman of the city. Like, if you pull out of certain trailer parks, if you pull out of certain, like, the cops watch those just as well as they watch the projects and the slums in the city. And yeah, like, there's notorious, like, you look at, like, the what is the border between Colorado and Kansas? Because Colorado's legal weed and Kansas is, like, super, you know, illegal weed. They, like, they're vultures, man. And a lot of people, they get pulled over to the line between Colorado and Kansas in the middle of fucking nowhere. Surprise, surprise. They're not black or Hispanic.
Right.
I think a lot of white folk found during the opioid crisis, during the meth crisis, that they are just as willing to rip and steal and violate our civil rights as they are any minority in this country. It is a case that, like, yeah, we're all in it together. And I'm not saying that I'm at the same risk of being pulled over. That's the same thing, risk of being searched. I'm just saying if I got wrong, if I am in that position, they're not going to cut me the benefit of the doubt. Because I'm a white guy that does podcasting, they're going to take my $15,000 and they're going to steal. They're going to steal it. I might be able to get it back if I can, but it might be gone by the time it gets there. Who knows? Like, oh, I don't know. We only took $10,000 off of you. Yeah, it's like they play those games. So I just disagree with you there, Eric. Maybe we'll get feedback on that. Walt says, as a born and bred Baltimorean who still lives in this city today, I thought I'd offer some subtext to the scene in episode 2 where Jenkins and a fellow officer are making arrests and a guy speeds past him on a dirt bike. Here they're referencing the 12 o'clock boys with a Z, a group of riders named after their high angle wheelies, which mimic a clock hand pointing upwards. While it's significant to the show is because in 1999, following an incident that resulted in a man's death, there was a crackdown on police tactics for pursuing these riders and a no-chase policy was instituted. As you can probably guess, it hasn't stopped rogue officers from ignoring the mandate and continuing their aggressive methods. If you're interested in learning more, I highly recommend the 2013 documentary 12 O'Clock Boys, directed by Lofty Nathan.
Sounds pretty interesting.
I haven't watched that documentary, but I have seen a couple of documentaries on these city bike gangs, four-wheeler gangs, ATV gangs. There's one that operates in Cincinnati and Covington. But I mean, I think it's fucked up that, like, essentially this crime, that there's no way to prosecute this crime. I think that's bullshit. It seems like with cameras and facial recognition technology and, you know, vehicle registration, you could assign 6 to 10 plainclothes cops and, like, shut this shit down in like a month or two. But that shit's hard. You know, busting people for drugs is easy. And you might make a career doing that. You're not going to make a career, you know, keeping our cities safe and less obnoxious from unlicensed off-road vehicle use, you know? But it's weird because it does get, like, you know, there's been incidences here in Cincinnati where they've shut down a whole freeway to do, like, wheelies and shit. So it's like, I don't know, but it's like there's when you've got, you know, 180 murders being committed in your city, the bike stuff seems like it's not that big a deal.
Sure.
California Dave, enjoying your coverage of We Own the City and your coverage of episode 2. You mentioned we should pay our police a couple of times. Kind of regretting that after this episode. Right. I just want to share some numbers on police pay in my area, San Jose, California. Now, granted, one of the most expensive places in the country, San Jose.
Yeah.
Heart of Silicon Valley. San Jose was the 10th largest city in the U.S. While we do get to enjoy great weather, it's an expensive place to live. Annual base pay rate for a police officer is $105,000 to $164,000. They get 4-day work weeks, 10-hour shifts. The 4 days a week is significant because it seems to create a lot of opportunity for overtime. 7 of the 10 top paid city employees worked at the San Jose police. Everyone on the list made over $400,000 in 2020. 7 out of the 10 top paid city employees worked as police.
Even in San Jose, 400K will go pretty far. I mean, most of the tech guys working there aren't making 400K a year.
Not unless you founded some shit. Some are top officials, but at least one on the list is a regular beat cop, and he made $453,000 in 2020. With a base salary in the mid to low hundreds, it seems reasonable to assume more than a few make over $200,000 a year. Is that too much or too little? I don't know, but I think most people, even out here, find those numbers surprising. P.S. Civil asset forfeiture and the police unions are the devil. No, man. I agree. I was running off outdated information that these cops got paid 40, 50, like a school teacher, you know, salary. And yeah, with overtime, they could maybe juice that up to $80, $90,000, which is still not
by, right?
Getting by in a city. But like, and this makes sense. Like when we think of like, you hear a lot of times like police budget, like the police budget of, I just recently saw the police budget of LA is like two or three times the military budget for Ukraine.
Jesus. Okay.
Who is, with again, some NATO help, successfully repelling an invasion from the fucking Russians. That's kind of crazy, I think.
How many people live in Ukraine? I don't know. The population is probably pretty comparable, 45, right?
50 million. Oh, there's way more people.
Like twice as many people there.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they don't, you know, the
landmass, it's just a much larger place. That's wild.
And that's where it's like, I don't know how successful, I do know how, it's not been very successful, the rhetoric about defunding the cops. Defunding the police, because like I understand the idea that you want to pull some of the money that we're paying police and you want to put it to social workers, you want to put it to homeless shelters, because that's going to ultimately stop. But to me, it's like it goes back to war on drugs and also the fact that like a lot of, if you want body cameras, more training, fire a bunch of cops, rehire a bunch of cops, that's going to take a bunch of money. It's not going to be free. Mm-hmm. You're not going to save money by doing those things.
And I have no problem paying a good cop $170,000 in Baltimore to do their job.
To risk their lives.
If they're doing it effectively, because it is it's a dangerous job. And it's a job that I'd have a hard time justifying doing myself. So like, pay these guys what they're worth, 100%. Just shut this bullshit down. That's just making everybody worse.
The other reality is, if you shut down the war on drugs, this job becomes a hell of a lot less dangerous.
Right.
The reason that cops are worried that every traffic stop could be the last one, last time I don't ever go home to my family. The reason that's true is because if you got 40 pounds of dope in your trunk, the charges for murdering the officer coming up to your car to bust you are going to be less than the weight you're doing for that. Like, so there's like an incentive to flee. There's an incentive to shoot. There's an incentive to, you know, get your stash house armed to the teeth. So when cop, you know what I'm saying? Like, and when you have police officers intentionally blurring the lines between patrol officers and plainclothes officers and undercover officers and people serving warrants and doing official police work, you're going to have more and more bodies. So it's like what we're doing is not working. It's making the cop's job more harder. It's making it more dangerous. It's like we're doing it to ourselves. We're collectively.
That's the thing. But the people in the system, you would think, would want to have a system that functioned better, made their job safer. But there's this strange incentive out there to make the job more dangerous, work harder, work more, because the pay goes up, right? If you can justify... Right. Like in your union negotiations with the city, say, hey, this job is extremely dangerous. Look at these crime statistics, right? Look, it keeps going up, keeps getting worse. We need more guys. They need to be paid more. We need more equipment. They have no incentive to fix this. The unions have no incentive to fix this because their guys are making bank off of it. And if the guys aren't so afraid for their lives because they've got, you know, tactical gear just on their guys who are just standing on the corner helping people out, if they've got all the tactical gear and automatic machine guns and shit like that, tanks, literal tanks in some cases. Right. Like, what do they care? Like, the job isn't actually getting more dangerous if they've got all this equipment. So just keep saying it is and justify the extra cost.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality is getting, you know, one of those MRAPs issued to your department is essentially free because the war on terror really gave a lot of surplus on that. Yep. Giving a cop a shotgun and an assault rifle and a level 3 bulletproof vest for every squad car is cheap. Getting a police that can solve a murder is hard, you know.
Yeah.
Apparently it's hard when you have so many focused on doing other shit. So I don't know. It's like it's wild. We it didn't take us this long to realize that alcohol was tearing our country apart and making the streets run red with blood and guns. It's taken us a lot longer to make the same realization about drugs. It's probably because of the huge racial component in the beginning. I feel like folks have really caught up to the averages with the meth and opioid crisis. And it's time for us all to kind of wake up about that. You can't imprison millions at the same time, too. Like, it's not just the bodies and the, you know, it's the erosion of our trust in our civic authorities. It's the fact that, like, mm-hmm. we have, you know, millions of people who are felons now that wouldn't otherwise be. It's just a fucking tragedy all around.
As a taxpayer, like, you talk about all these wrongful arrest lawsuits, right, that they're having to pay out settlements for. The city has to pay those out. As a taxpayer, I would much rather them pay out wrongful firings for the union than pay out these fees on what makes our cities fundamentally worse. I'd rather fire the wrong cop a couple times and have that blow back on us and pay the $1 million to them as opposed to having these guys out on the streets.
Or if it's like, cause like, you know, it turns out it's actually, believe it or not, it's more expensive to execute a person than it is to keep them in life in prison. And it's about the appeals process and how much judicial work is involved in like doing all that. Uh-huh. If it turns out, like, if we want to bust a guy down, a bad cop down to desk duty, and where they're not eligible for overtime and they're going to finish out the rest of their career making, you know, $75,000-$80,000. Like, that might suck for another till they get to retirement year. But if that, you know, is seen as a penalty that keeps them off the streets and keeps them from lining their pockets, like, I'm cool with that. Like, there's multiple
I want to pay for good policing. I hate paying for this bad shit that's happening.
Oh, yeah. Imagine if you had to play Hershel $1 million to make him go away. And the guys racked up $25 million in police complaint money over the years. Like, that's a net savings, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, Jesus Christ. I don't need these guys on a firing squad. I just need them off the streets. Right. Because that's the completely nihilistic thing that I've not considered in all of this is how worthless it makes police work. That you get to a situation where, like, it's not only do you have these officers who anything that they touch is unprosecutable. Mm-hmm. And they're still on the streets prosecuting it. But that gets known to the city to where even the good cops that don't do that stuff, you can't trust that they're good cops because, hell, we got our hero cops running around doing this shit. Mm-hmm. Thank you, David Simon and George Pelicanos, for depressing the hell out of me for another week. do you have anything else you want to talk about, Jim?
No, I'm good.
All right. corners@baldmove.com is how you send us feedback. We got 2 more weeks to consult and talk about this. I'm really curious about like what clearly the other shoe to drop is this drug thing, because I think that's going to be shocking to even corrupt cops. Not just that, but like that Wayne is become perhaps one of the largest drug dealers in Baltimore.
Oh, you think so? Okay.
Because I do think that, like, yeah, like the cops, you can see with war, there's a fundamental difference. Like, well, yeah, we tax drug dealers. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. Versus we're now taking these kilos and moving them back on the street, you know?
Well, and the other side of that is Gonda, who's actively working with the drug dealers, right? It's not even that he's not taxing them. He's working with them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's the other shoe that's yet to drop. We'll see how that goes. All right. That's it. That's it for We Own. We're taking back our corners. We'll be back next week with another episode. Send in that feedback to corners@baldmove.com. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.